another edition of what I call American Exposé. Into its 10-year, it's the 10th year of operation of American Exposé. Yeah, I took a year and a half off. Out of frustration, I did. And I suppose it's God's will that I'm back. You listeners wanted it back, and so here I am. But these situations that we live under today, the Hegelian dialectic, what gives us the right to think this is a weather modification action or that this is a natural disaster? We have no right. We have no privy to the information. We do know statements like U.S. Secretary Cohen expressing concern about eco-terrorism using scalar electromagnetic weapons. Quote, listen to this. Others are engaging even in an echo type of terrorism whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes, remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. So there are plenty of ingenious minds out there that are at work finding ways in which they can wreak terror upon other nations. It's real, and that's the reason why we have to intensify our efforts, and meaning counterterrorism efforts, and that's an end quote. So that was Secretary of Defense Cohen in an April 1997 counterterrorism conference sponsored by former Senator Sam Nunn. So, listeners, he makes this statement that it's a reality. And I have more. But I look at yesterday's paper. It's just heartbreaking, is the front page article. Hurricane death toll still rising, and obviously that's going to be the case for a long time. You're looking at the cameras as the helicopters are flying over these devastated areas, and you're seeing homes flooded. There could be a lot of dead bodies in those homes, people. They did not want to leave. They did not want to be evacuated. I can't blame them for not wanting to be evacuated. And once again, was this a created crisis? I believe it was. I'm not going to sit back and think that this is natural because, listeners, we've had too many Pearl Harbors already. 9/11, Gulf of Tonkin for the Vietnam War, perfect examples of created scenarios to bring us to where we are. The tremendous media publications that are going on right now in the press and the television press is phenomenal. This has taken all the pressure off George Bush and his Iraq war, which is actually a UN war, when you do the research. If you don't do the research, you're in the dark about everything, listeners. So, as I turn through the page, they're talking about poverty. Poverty declines in state, but uninsured rate grows. Declines how much? Survey also reported a drop in Oklahoma's poverty rate. Oklahoma is now the 11th poorest state, up from 9th in 2003. Well, gee, look at how we are with the Federal Reserve debt and owed dollar today. The way we're being maneuvered and manipulated with legal tender for all debts, public and private. On page 4 of the paper, two governors declare a crisis along border. And obviously, you know what that is, listeners. Chinese leader seeks to ally U.S. worries on page 5. This is only the beginning of the front page. We're going to have Will with us at the bottom of the hour, but I want to cover some bases before we bring him up. And certainly, the created crisis right now, in my opinion, is taking all the pressure off this Iraqi war where our sons and daughters are dying in the Middle East. Another Vietnam. Obvious to me. We'll be back. Stay with us. Broadcast. As you watch it unfold on the television, you can read it unfolding on AmericanExpose.com. Bush taps father Clinton for relief help. We just saw it on the telly, and Dennis put it on the internet on AmericanExpose.com. Bush taps father Clinton for relief help. Germany says ready to help U.S. with Katrina. France may mobilize relief for Caribbean. U.S. declines offer of Russian rescue plane. Oh, yes. Could very well be Russia was behind this. At the branch of the Security Council, at the top of the Security Council, where no one is privy to what goes on at the Security Council, unless it's the White House and the rest of New York City, meaning the UN building itself, I don't know. But the Security Council of the UN system is very prominent in this, always headed by a Russian or a Russian satellite country, according to the sources I've covered in the past. It's very, very secretive direction. More than 95% of Gulf oil production lost. There's the key, listeners, right there. We're losing our ability to travel. Right there. That would be a good indicator that this was created. A very good indicator. Oil climbs as U.S. scrambles for fuel. U.S. oil struggles to recover from Katrina. Michael Chertoff called it Katerina. Here you see the body count is going to increase. The relief effort is coming in place. But then you look at the paper under today, two governors declare crisis along border. Arizona and New Mexico deal with rising crime. We all understand what that's about. But it's in the paper, people. Then Chinese leader Beijing, out of Beijing, President Hu Jintao, hopes to ease American concerns about China's growing economic and military might during his visit to the United States next week. Hu is due to arrive Monday in the United States at the start of a two-week trip that also includes stops, get this, listeners, in Canada and Mexico at the United Nations as well. So, this is the point. This is the direction. This is the situation. China is part of the Security Council of the UN system. Then we see New Orleans become swamp. Flooding may continue, area told. This is page 8. Page 9, like a tsunami. Oklahoma Baptists send mission of aid. State helps Gulf areas to recover. Oklahoma volunteers help with survivors' needs. Page 10 of the front page of yesterday's Oklahoman. Inhofe urges Bush to tap petroleum reserve. Well, it's just been disclosed that these petroleum reserves up here in Oklahoma, the ability to get that refinery, the four refineries, is not going to be done, not able to be done for certain purposes. But here's the piece of the picture that connects all the dots to me and where we are going today with sustainable communities and smart growth. On page 11A of the front page, 158 landowners set to receive watershed funds, listeners. This is a major part of a chapter of Agenda 21. This is where you need to do your research into finding out where it is. I'm not going to hold your hand. I'm going to let you have the opportunity to do your own research, because without your researching, without your going through that mess of words that they put together on all these chapters of Agenda 21, you really don't know whether it's Agenda 21 or not. You have to find out for yourself. So, according to this, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will pay 158 Oklahoma landowners about $700,000 to protect four state watersheds, a state conservationist said Tuesday. There it is, listeners. The Conservation Security Program, that's the Conservation Security Program, is like a pat on the back for landowners who already have conservation efforts in place, said Kevin Norton, assistant state conservationist with the U.S. Natural Resources Conservation Service, the agency that manages the program for the USDA. Quote, the intent of the program is to reward those who are operating at a high level of conservation stewardship and create the initiative for others to move their conservation efforts up to a very high level, end quote, Norton said. The Conservation Security Program provides farmers and ranchers with financial and technical assistance to improve soil, water, air, vegetation, and animal life around selected watersheds throughout the United States. That all sounds nice and comfortable. But ultimately, in the end goal of this whole thing, as people die off that own the land, They lose the land. That's what the payoff is here, listeners. As they do their stewardship direction, they get the funding from the USDA. When they die, they lose the land. It goes back to the government. This is as I see it. It goes on, people. The Conservation Security Program contracts for 2005 include four areas. The Lower Cimarron River Skeleton Creek Watershed in Alfalfa, Blaine, Canadian, Garfield, Kingfisher, Logan, Major, and Oklahoma counties. The Lower Neshoah River Watershed in Cherokee, Craig, Delaware, Mays, Muskogee, Ottawa, Rogers, and Wagner counties. The Little River Watershed in Cleveland, Hughes, Oklahoma, Potawatomi, and Seminole counties. The Lower Salt Fork of the Arkansas River Watershed in Alfalfa, Grant, Garfield, Kay, and Noble counties. The 158 contacts this year mark an increase from 136 announced in July by the Agriculture Department. Four more contracts still could be signed, according to Norton. The 2005 contracts will run from 5 to 10 years. Nationwide, more than $1 billion will be paid out over the next 10 years for program contracts granted this year. In 2004, 165 Oklahoma landowners signed Conservation Security Program contracts, Norton said. At that time, only the Lower Salt Fork of the Arkansas watershed was a selective watershed. The contracts from 2004 also run from 5 to 10 years, Norton said. These contracts paid out about $1.2 million. The 2002 Farm Bill authorized the Conservation Security Program. Now, legislation could be put in place down the road where all those lands can be taken down the road. And that is the situation that we have, people. You don't think this was created today, this weather anomaly. 109th Congress, first session, S-517, to establish the Weather Modification Operations and Research Board and for other purposes, March 3rd, 2005. This is just another new piece of legislation. It's already in place in the U.S. Code. Weather modification is there. You learn about the Weather Modification Advisory Research Board, and there's established the Department of Commerce, the Weather Modification Advisory and Research Board. The board may establish advisory committees to advise the board and make recommendations to the board concerning legislation, policies, administration, research, and for other matters. Duties of the board, promotion of research and development in order to assist in expanding the theoretical and practical knowledge of weather modification. The board shall promote and fund research and development studies and investigations with respect to improved forecast and decision-making technologies for weather modification operations. The powers of the board, as I go to Section 6, studies, investigations, and hearings. The board may make any studies or investigations, obtain any information, and hold any hearings necessary or proper to administer and enforce this act or any rules or orders issued under this act. There's cooperative agreements, there's conduct and contracts for research and development, cooperation with the Weather Modification Operations and Research Board. Section 7, listeners, this is legislation pending. I don't know what the status is of this legislation. Once again, it is S-517 by Mrs. Hutchinson. The heads of the departments and agencies of the United States and the heads of any other public or private agencies and institutions that research or receive research funds from the United States shall, to the extent possible, give full support and cooperation to the board and to initiate independent research and development programs that address weather modifications. All a reality. All a reality, listeners. Then you have the Population and Sustainability Network. Have you ever heard of them? Population Development and Poverty Reduction, Rethinking Reproductive Health in the Big Picture. This is the Population and Sustainability Network. It is an advisory group which aims to bring together development, environment, and reproductive health NGOs, government departments, academics, and others, to increase leverage on population issues. Increase leverage on population issues, listener. It endeavors to provide a space in which different constituencies can learn from each other. It is hoped that such increases in understanding of the issues will inform the strategies and activities of network members. And bear with me on this, listeners. We have more to cover here to connect dots to where this situation takes us that we're involved in right now. Oil production is at a halt. Gas is going to continue. We're encouraged not to drive. How long is this going to last when the refineries are destroyed? There's the point and the problem. Stay with us. Bear with us. We'll be back. Jazz is great. Where would I be without jazz today? Listeners, it's very important to connect these dots. Sustainable development and natural hazard mitigation. 1 January 1999. Sustainable development and natural hazard mitigation, people. This is Darren Weeks' research, as Dennis does his research. A combination that is pretty incredible on AmericanExpose.com. And on page 7 of this, Sustainable Development and Natural Hazard Mitigation, A New Approach to Development Decision Making is the title of this section on page 7. And you can find this yourself on Monday's date. It is clear then that our current modus operandi cannot be continued indefinitely. Human use or overuse of the world's resources, including our methods of staking out new territory, are unsustainable. That is, we cannot expect to carry on at this rate with the same returns forever and without irreparable damage to ourselves and future generations. In fact, children alive today will in all likelihood face a very different world when they are adults and making development decisions of their own. We must do what is in our power now to see that we do not limit their choices through thoughtless decisions we make. Fortunately, sustainable development has emerged as a paradigm with potential to give human beings the perspective and power they need to rediscover our proper niche in the Earth's panoply. Indeed, sustainable development may be seen as a moral imperative that we must pursue more thoughtful ways, must change our values and assumptions, must consider beyond the here and now. The concept of natural hazard mitigation, that's natural hazard mitigation, falls neatly under the broader umbrella of sustainable development as one of the ways by which we can change our current self and eco-destructive habits. The hazard mitigation is one of the pillars of sustainable development. We can make our development decisions in such a way as to make the built environment more resilient to the impacts of natural hazards, thereby decreasing the future vulnerability of human life and property while bolstering the long-term viability of natural ecosystems and human communities. Now, this is getting rather lengthy. And, shoot, I have a planned direction with the program today. But defining sustainable development and hazard mitigation is very important, too. But we move on. Listen to this on page 9. There are also a myriad interpretations of what constitutes hazard mitigation. But one standard definition used by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, describes natural hazard mitigation as, quote, any action taken to reduce or eliminate the long-term risk to human life and property from natural hazards, end quote. This can involve a variety of activities ranging from minor structural changes to existing building and make it more resilient to the impacts of natural hazards. Shared Principles of Sustainable Development and Hazard Mitigation is on page 9 as well. There's more to this. Listen to this. The first such important common element is the recognition that these are qualitative concepts and do not necessarily involve quantitative measures. Sustainable development communicates a concern that what kind of development, rather than how much, while hazard mitigation encourages development that is built to standards designed to withstand likely hazard impacts and is located in areas that minimize these impacts. Neither principle necessarily proposes a no-growth policy for communities to become less vulnerable and more sustainable. Rather, these concepts advocate for the safe accommodation of future population rise through conscientiously controlled growth and development. I'm rushing now. I better put this aside because I have something else to cover. But we'll come back to this as we can. This is very, very important as well. Listen carefully to this. A campaign for political ecology. The case for dramatically reducing human numbers. In the journal Politics and Life Sciences of September 1997, Professor Kenneth Smale, S-M-A-I-L, Smale, made the case for dramatically reducing human numbers. And leading commentators in the field of population and development contributed their views on it. What follows are summaries, the keynote paper, and responses. The summary was prepared by Val Stevens in June 1999. When we were embroiled in 1999, Y2K. So, number one, Kenneth Smale, the case for dramatically reducing human numbers. Smale identifies two irreconcilable trends of thought. First, the predictions that the human population will grow to some 10 to 12 billion in 50 years' time. Second, scientific estimates that only 2 to 3 billion people can be sustainably supported at a comfortable level. That's 2 to 3 billion people, listeners. 2 to 3 billion. That means 4 billion people have to be eliminated in the world right now. He believes that within the next 50 years, we must have a place in place an internationally coordinated, broadly equitable, voluntary set of initiatives to dramatically reduce populations. Because it will take 50 years of consensus building, it should start right now. In the age of inexpensive energy, adequate food supplies, readily available or easily extractable, raw material, plentiful fish and water, readily accessible, blah, 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 are coming to a close. I hope I'm connecting dots that you're willing to understand and research for yourselves, listeners.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the broadcast. You know, as we're dealing with Iraq and then Iran and then Syria, we're aiding Beijing. We're aiding Beijing, China, listeners. That should really shock you, really make you concerned, but most aren't. One of my people here had an aha moment this morning concerning gas prices. She was watching C-SPAN when the National Press Club program came on. The speaker was Stephen Brobick, Executive Director of the Consumer Federation of America. They released a national survey on attitudes on gas prices. During the presentation, he mentioned Americans' dependence on foreign oil. And interestingly, the attitudes on the high price of gasoline, especially in the rural areas, and the fact that America is underpopulated. The aha moment is that the traders will try to use the high price of gasoline to justify hemispheric integration, because Mexico and Venezuela have plenty of oil, which would reduce America's dependence on foreign oil. In other words, we'll get cheap oil as the immigration or the migration comes to America. Maybe? Hmm? Makes sense. Let's take Tim in Texas. I'm sorry for your wait, Tim, but I had to get over some of this. Tim, welcome.
Not a problem. It's a rather busy time for you, I know.
Mm-hmm.
It ruined my show last night. I couldn't even hardly play last night. You know, I've been watching this thing from from minute one. I've been watching this thing from the minute that that hurricane was headed west, made a 90-degree turn, and headed straight for New Orleans. And I sat and I watched it all day long. And that's when I called you, and that's when you took over watching it.
Yeah.
And that hurricane made a 90-degree right-hand turn at New Orleans and hit Biloxi. And that is unprecedented. You had the weather, the man that had written the weather book on the other day telling us about that. That hurricanes just do not do that. Okay? That's the first thing.
That was James McCanny.
Yeah, James McCanny. Tremendous information he had. So we know the hurricane was at least directed. When I came home last night, I noticed the price of gas, and this morning it was up 30 cents. I'm 90 miles from the Texas refineries. My gas is $2.79 for regular. And that's at the cheapest place out here in the rural areas. So it's more expensive in the city, like in Austin. Out here it's $2.79. It just went up. The man said he could show me the invoice. And he said, also, look for $5.
Easy.
Yeah. He said, look for $5. Possibly within a week.
Now, to think this was naturally created.
Yeah, this is,
it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, if anybody think this is all natural, they have their head buried somewhere beside the sand.
Easy. Does it.
Yeah.
We're all on the same side. Trying to do the right thing.
Before I left last night, Chris, I was watching, and I don't remember which station it was on, but they had the CEO or the owner of whoever he was of BP. And they were talking about these problems with this fuel and stuff. And, of course, he was, you know, his normal whatever you call it that comes out of his mouth. And he let it slip. The commentator asked him, well, sir, we've got to get these prices down. How can we get these prices down? And the man responded, well, you have to reduce demand.
Yeah, stop driving.
He said, well, how can we reduce demand? And he said, quote, we make the product so high that people can't buy it. That's how you reduce the demand. They cut the guy off so fast when he said that. And I haven't seen it since.
Very observant of you.
And it's just little things that if you watch this, I watch all of them at the same time. As one goes to commercial, I flip back, or if they, you know, start talking to me. I watch all of them at the same time, yet I listen to your show in my ear. Okay, and it takes watching it like this to catch these statements. And calling into these radio shows like yours puts them on record. I saw it with my own two eyes. The CEO of BP says the way we're going to reduce demand is by making the product so expensive that most people can't buy it.
BP meaning British Petroleum?
I don't know, Chris.
Okay.
And one more thing, and I'll clear the line. I have a buddy, Ricky Norman, in Louisiana. Ricky, if you're listening to the show, please call in and tell us you're okay. I haven't heard from him since, no emails or nothing.
He might have a difficult time doing that.
So if he's got his shortwave cranked up on WWCR, Ricky, if you can, call and let us know you're all right, buddy. Chris, thanks a lot, my friend.
Okay, Tim, thank you.
God bless. Bye.
Bye-bye. So you see all this coming together. The high price of gasoline is going to continue. The direction is in place. Lindsey Williams predicted this, and here's the way it happened. We have no choice but to accept this high price of gasoline because of the scenario that came about here. Now, I have Will in Missouri, and what I was connecting the dot to the other day was the United States mission to the European Union. GPS and the EU's Galileo program. Secretary of State Colin Powell hailed the new U.S.-EU agreement on global positioning system, GPS Galileo cooperation, as a remarkable achievement at a signing ceremony June 26, and I would believe this was 2004. And that was in Shannon, Ireland, during the U.S.-EU summit. The U.S. GPS system consists of satellites broadcasting signals that can be converted into precise positioning and timing information anywhere in the world, listeners, anywhere in the world. In 1998, the European Union decided to develop its own satellite navigation system, which it was called Galileo. This pertains to Chapter 40 of Agenda 21, listeners. When you connect these dots, it's very easy to see this. And the United States and European Union have completed negotiations on an agreement to harmonize their respective satellite navigation systems. The existing U.S. Global Positioning Satellite System and the planned European Galileo System. The agreement is scheduled to be signed June 26, 2004 by Secretary of State Colin Powell. So we see the GIS, that's the Global Information System, is on the website as well. That's the Global Information System. We have the United States mission to the European Union, and then we go to Chapter 40 of Agenda 21, which very well lays it out for us, if I can get it up on the screen, which talks about using satellite technology for various purposes. For various purposes. And it's slow in coming up for me, and so I can't just quote it right now because I don't have it in front of me on print, and it does come up, and we're looking at 40-12, where it states here, let's see, well, it's, let's bring Will up while I look for this, and this is the pretext of him coming up, is the fact that this just rung a bell in his head. Oh, yeah, here it goes. So, Will, welcome to the broadcast.
Well, good afternoon, Chris, and thank you for inviting me to join you on the airwaves.
Yeah, my privilege. Now, what was the reasoning why you called that day regarding this GIS and GPS global positioning system with the satellites?
All right. There's an instantaneous trigger that goes off in my mind whenever we talk about this, rolls back to about 1970. When I was working for a large engineering company out on the West Coast, and we had an entire division of people, they were called the Word Group, that were on computers at a time when computers technology was still beginning. And basically what we were doing as an engineering company, we were tapping into what is called the Superfund cleanup money. And that Superfund was a federal appropriation to go around to places where DuPont and GE and Boeing and other companies had messed their mess kit, so to speak, and using tax dollar revenue, we would go in and map those areas out and propose plans for doing cleanup on those sites to reduce the hazardous waste, all of it being on the back of the taxpayer rather than on those that profited from it originally. And they may have had to pay some kind of a copay. That I don't know about. But the idea behind a GIS, in those days we called them a geographic information system, basically is a two-part system. It works with a group of land surveyors actually on the ground doing physical mapping and identification of attributes, the word you use, attributes of various and sundry interests. And then you load that information up into either through AutoCAD or any of VersaCAD or any of the digital mapping systems, and you put all that information together, and then that begins what you would consider a map, a base for a geographic information system. Now, that's the pretense. That's the place to begin, and like everything that goes, it always has a happy face on it. But the downside of it is that that's just the first layer of information. From that, then you can go ahead and lay in tax assessor's maps. You can lay in ownership records. Another layer, you could put in all of the water systems. On another layer, you could put in all the sewer systems. You can put in all the roads, all the monuments, all the well locations, all the meter locations, all your culverts, drainages, your runoff basins, your stormwater areas, and you just continue to build. And because it's in the computer, it's so much different than it used to be in the old days, where the draftsman had to just crowd as much material as they could into little areas or work on so many maps that no one could turn the pages fast enough. But with the computer, you can actually pull up somebody's property, let's say by the tax account number, and just with a mouse button, you can click back and forth between all manner of information. And as the database continues to grow, it's conceivable that your children's school records, your dog's veterinary records, your horse's records, how many pigs and cows you reported on your personal property taxes, whether you have a tractor or don't have a tractor, all of that information could be accessed at a click point. Now, you could take that information as itself, as long as it was used properly, it wouldn't be draconian, but if it's used adversely, then it would certainly be egregious. But if you take that and ratchet up the next level and add the geographic positioning system, a global GPS mapping system, what that does is for all of those attributes, it establishes a horizontal, like a northing and an easting coordinate, and a vertical coordinate on it, so that you have this stuff down to the point of a gnat's eyebrow. And at that point, basically from 60,000 feet, you could put a cluster bomb on a specific house, plus or minus.
And there you have a thought that is not something to be discarded, listeners. Now, I go to Chapter 40, and we're on 40.13. Listen carefully to this of Agenda 21, institutional capacity to integrate environment and development and to develop relevant indicators is lacking at both the national and international levels. Existing institutions and programs such as the Global Environmental Monitoring System, GEMS, GEMS, the Global Environmental Monitoring System, and the Global Resource Information Database, GRID, G-R-I-D, the Global Resource Information Database, within the UNEP, that's the UN Environment Program, and different entities within the system-wide Earthwatch, will need to be considerably strengthened. Earthwatch has been an essential element of environmental-related data. While programs related to development data exist in a number of agencies, there is insufficient coordination between them. The activities related to development data for agencies and institutions of the United Nations system should be more effectively coordinated, perhaps through an equivalent and complementary development watch, which, with the existing Earth Watch, should be coordinated through an appropriate office within the United Nations to ensure the full integration of environment and development concerns, listeners. And this is 1992 now, Will. This is 1992. Go ahead.
Let's tie this back again a little tighter now. So we have a geographic information system, which is basically database entries and mapping on a computer. Then we add to that the layer of three-dimensional coordinate geometry, which will pinpoint it very precisely. And then on the ground, through the spreading of what is called in the rural areas enhanced 911, that process is sold to the public so that your two-year-old could pick up the telephone and call 911, and they would instantly get an operator. But the way that it's applied is that when a county falls for the trap, then the E91 board, which is at first, for 2 years at least, a non-elected appointed board, that board then brings in this UN agenda system of addressing. But in addition to that, they also establish a series of towers and repeating towers throughout the county that you live in so that they're all interconnected within the range of a cell phone. Now, that doesn't sound too horrible until you think of it in the terms of the whole grid being put in. But once those towers are built and hung there, then the tower can be leased out to another person. So you might get someone that comes in and puts in television systems, or you might get other competing telephone carriers in there, and you could get whatever you can hang on a tower interconnected on a series of elevated towers that were tax-funded. Now, we talk about weather modification, mind control. I'm not going to go into all those. You're the expert. But I just let the listeners connect the dots, is that we're paying through the 911 system for a new addressing system, a new addressing database, in the counties that I live in, up here in southwest Missouri. The addresses are changed, the street names are altered, things are reorganized. And for those that are astute, you know that your name, all caps name, your address, is an identity. And so if the local U911 board changes your address, they're actually changing your corporate ID, so to speak. But they're also throw that expense on the taxpayer as well, because then the taxpayer has to change all of their paper material. But the idea behind the E911 goes beyond just regular consideration for emergency preparedness. When you consider that the mapping technology, now you've probably gotten throwaway catalogs in your mailbox, and in those catalogs you'll see advertisements for electronic maps and things that you put on your dashboard so that you no longer have a paper map.
Yes.
Whatever GPS can read, it can talk to.
Very, very interesting, listeners. We continue with Will in Missouri today and Chapter 40 of Agenda 21. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to the broadcast. That is Poker Face. Their website is pokerface.com. This situation down here south of us, this latest weather anomaly, this latest disaster, is going to give the pretext for chipping people in the future, because you'll never be lost. You'll always be able to be found. So the pretext for microchipping individuals is going to come out of this as well. This is obvious to me. The information I've covered in the last hour here can be found on AmericanExpose.com, American spelled with a K, and Unattractive.com, which is on our website. So all this is working together. Now we go to Chapter 40, 24, 40.24. Listen carefully to this. Organs, the organs and organizations of the United Nations system. And we're part of we are the United Nations system, listeners. All our federal agencies work with the United Nations system. That was done by executive order by Richard Nixon in 1970. The organs and organizations of the United Nations system, as well as other governmental and non-governmental organizations, should document and share information about the sources of available information in their respective organizations. Existing programs, such as those of the Advisory Committee for the Coordination of Information Systems, that's the ACCIS, the Advisory Committee for the Coordination of Information Systems, and the International Environmental Information System, that's Infoterra, I-N-F-O-T-E-R-R-A, that's the International Environmental Information System, should be reviewed and strengthened as required. Networking and coordinating mechanisms should be encouraged between the wide variety of other actors, including arrangement with non-governmental organizations for information sharing and donor activities for sharing information on sustainable development projects. The private sector should be encouraged to strengthen the mechanisms of sharing its experience and information on sustainable development. Now, the other night I was connecting the dots to the Security Council of the UN, non-governmental organizations at the Security Council level, and sustainable development. So this is all on track, listeners. Will, your comments before we close out this hour.
All right. On that one, Chris, if you think of all of the organs, first of all, if you go through the Chambers of Commerce, all of the members of Chambers of Commerce are organs of the great tissue of the supreme being, which is the state. And on your local level, the turtle meter, there's a kind of a meter that's been put into the rural meters, perhaps in the local, in the urban areas as well, but it's a reporting meter so that they don't have to come out ostensibly to read your meter. Well, that meter is keeping track of your usage on a minute-by-minute day throughout the entire day. That also is tied into the GIS, and so it's possible to know when you're awake, when you're sleeping, what your regular consumption patterns are, when you hit the air conditioner, when you turn off the coffee pot, when you turn on the coffee pot, and so it pretty fairly well maps it out. And combined with the E911 system, plus all of the various databases, it's really not necessary to go to a judge and ask for a warrant to search the contents of a house. You virtually can do it from the driveway.
Will, I got involved in a phone call here. Are you there?
I'm still here.
What were you saying?
Okay, well, what I basically was bringing on was another layer, which is adding in your turtle meter, the electric meter on your, there's a reporting electric meter.
Yes.
If you look at your meter, if there's an LED light that's shining, you look inside, there's a small chip on a board. that's probably a reporting meter. You probably haven't seen anybody come by to read your meter.
There you have it. There you have it.
You can add that to the water meters, which will be fully reporting as well, and now we'll know not only when you're awake and when you're asleep, but when you usually brush your teeth.
Sam in Missouri will be with us. He will join us momentarily in the second hour of American Exposé on RBN. Stay with us.